Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Events of the past week or so are a grim reminder that we are in anything but a so-called post-racial period. Our first guest is an educator, author who has given a lot of thought to the subject of racism, specifically racism and spirituality, racism and white privilege. Dr. Shelley Touchluck, is a social justice advocate who chairs the education department at Mount St. Mary's University in Los Angeles. She is the author of Living in the Tension, The Quest for a Spiritualized Racial Justice. Her earlier book is Witnessing Whiteness, The Need to Talk About Race and How to Do It. It's been the subject of numerous provocative group discussions, including many here conducted by the YWCA. Shelley Touchluck joins me in studio. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this is an interesting time to be talking about racism, activism, spirituality, and white privilege. Are we moving forward or backward, do you think, in these areas, given today's environment?
I think we're doing both right now. Yeah. I think there's a good amount of our population that is in a reactive stance around issues of multiculturalism, diversity, inclusivity, any of the words that tend to spark an idea of we're supposed to change. And I think there are a whole lot of people who are really moving forward in their understanding of how important it is for all of us to really get a handle on how race has impacted everyone in our society and continues to do so.
Who are the people who are standing still?
I think there are a lot of people who are just tuning out. I still think there are people who are disengaging. It's a challenging subject to take on. And so for those who don't necessarily want to be on the side of those reacting in a contrary way and also aren't understanding the issues sufficiently to say, hey, I want to be on board with movement forward, those are those I would suggest might be standing still.
I gather from your first book, Witnessing Whiteness, that you're talking about white people being sort of reluctant to take this on and really absorb it and digest it.
For me, that is my focus because I'm a white person. Uh-huh. I've looked really deeply at my own white experience, and as I sought out others to talk to and about this to get a handle on it for myself, I kept talking to more and more white people. And over time, I found that a whole lot of people felt a lot like I did or were struggling with the same issues that I was struggling with, fears and thoughts and confusions. And so I do tend to focus on white people, it's true.
What are and were some of those fears and confusions?
I think confusion is the world doesn't operate for everybody the way we often think that it does. And I know for myself, growing up in a fairly white area in Orange County, California, I was raised to believe that if I just stayed the course and pursued my education, that I would have thoughts and assumptions about how the world worked that would match for everybody. And it wasn't until I got into a teaching experience in the inner city when I was helped to be informed by many of my colleagues who are mm-hmm. both African American and Latino that my expectations and assumptions for how the world worked were not experienced by them in the same way.
It sounds like early on, as you were growing up, you were just allowing then what is being called white privilege to just take its course.
Absolutely. I definitely was raised in an environment with loving parents who I think both had diverse experiences, but they had been raised during, during the 50s, 60s time period, and were steeped in the idea of colorblindness, that if we just kept moving forward and were good to the people around us, that racism would go away, and that was our job, was just to be good to one another when we were around somebody. It wasn't really a conscious effort. It wasn't about dismantling systems. And so I did not get that training in my early life. No.
What a miscalculation that was.
It was.
Yeah.
I mean, lovingly given.
Well, of course, because that's the way it was. That's how we always look back. That's the way it was, and that's the way we acted.
Right.
But I'm concerned, Shelley, about what's going on today.
Yeah.
And I asked initially whether we're moving forward or not. It seems to me that we're moving more backward than forward, given this current environment. I mean, people seem to be killing each other with greater frequency.
think to some degree, I've heard it said, I'm quoting somebody else, that things are being uncovered more than they're potentially changing in terms of if we actually look at the statistics. I don't have those at my ready, but I do think that with the advent of social media and people capturing things on video so much more, I'm not altogether certain that that some of these things weren't always going on and that they were just being dismissed. I do agree, however, and I think it's right to say that the fervent and vitriolic conversations and the attacks, those seem to be absolutely heightening. Again, I wonder if it's just that people are being given permission to be more vocal about it right now, which is also an opportunity for us to become aware of what really is out there.
I wonder if the current political environment is playing a role, because some of the rhetoric that we're hearing from very top of the political food chain is pretty inflammatory.
I think it's highly concerning, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do we do about that? We just have to wade through it, I suppose.
I think that the way we converse with the people around us makes a big difference. I think every single one of us moving into this political cycle has an opportunity to either stay silent or to be vocal or to express that exact commentary that this is inflammatory. This is not useful. It's not healthy for us as a nation. And we can all do something about it.
But, you know, you indicate in Witnessing Whiteness that people, white people in particular, are reluctant.
Which is all the more reason why we need to be looking at ourselves and starting to have those conversations and not just turn it off.
I understand the need and I understand what you're saying, but if they're reluctant to talk about it, how do you make them talk about it?
Well, I think that's for everybody, right? So if I go to my closest people and I say, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking about today. This is what I'm concerned about today. This is what I read about today. What do you think about that? It does take a certain amount of courage. What I am hopeful about and excited about and where I do see the progression forward part coming in is that there are so many more, particularly white people, who are taking up this conversation and supporting each other in doing so. So the what do we do? I would suggest that every person that is white and concerned about these issues to go to a particular website that is put forward by Surge. It's Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's surj.org. And it's specifically for white people who are wanting to show up for racial justice. The resources there are immense. They are rapidly growing. And there are chapters all over the nation now where we as white people can get together. Part of it has an activist bent and movement forward. How do we take action? But there are also many resources around how do we talk to one another about this?
Well, shouldn't black people be having the same conversation?
Sure. But Surge is specifically for white people to do so. I think that's where, for me, the work that I'm doing is honoring the fact that I think every group has its work to do to recover from the racial trauma that we've experienced in this nation. I specifically can speak more readily to the white experience. I think black people can speak more readily to the black experience. And I know there are people who are doing that. And so I feel perfectly comfortable working in parallel and in solidarity with my cross-race
friends. Seems to me that what we have to do is have the black people and the white people talking to each other.
I think both need to happen. I think if we stay in parallel only, that's certainly a problem. Yeah. But the thing is that there also need to be places where black people can do their own work, white people can do their own work, and then, of course, we need to come together. And that, I do believe, is happening as well. So Surge doesn't operate in isolation. The Surge chapters usually are working in solidarity with people of color within their own environments.
We'll put a link to that website on our website, stlpublicradio.org, so people can have a look. What about the role of young people in all of this?
I think young people are extremely important. I think there is... this is where the both and that I write about in the new book, I think, is so important. I think elders have a lot to contribute, and I think young people have a lot to contribute. And I think anytime we get ourselves situated in one place where we say, oh, well, this group needs to learn from that group, only we find ourselves in problem. I've been around so many young people who have really grown up with an awareness from early life, and their insights are extremely nuanced and helpful.
And they have the energy. We've noticed that post-Ferguson, that it's the young people really who have taken the lead for the most part.
And I think following that lead is really important. And I hope that young people have an opportunity to also learn the lessons that the elders that came before them have learned and can offer. And I also think that can happen as well.
How are you connecting the dots between spirituality and activism and racism?
Yeah, something that started concerning me a number of years ago is the fact that, at least in my particular very personal environment, I was seeing a lot of disconnections. And so in feeling extremely challenged in sort of spiritual domains where racial justice wasn't seemingly part of the conversation, I personally recognize that I myself, as a spiritual being, someone who believes that I am trying to increase my consciousness about who I am in a very deep way, my racial position is part of who I am in a very deep way. And so I connect it, because if I'm unaware of how racial advantage, racial privilege, whatever words you want to put on it, whatever the socialization has been that has caused me to see certain people a certain way, to feel fear in a certain way, to feel confused in a certain way, to have assumptions in a certain way, if I can't become conscious of that, then something, some deep part of myself is, I think, inhibited, because I want to be as conscious as I can, so that when I am working with someone, when I'm interacting with someone, when I'm making commentary, that I can be as fully knowledgeable as I can and not hurt somebody and step in those holes of injury that I think are still really open wounds.
How greatly have you changed personally as you've taken this on this journey?
Probably a 180-degree turn. Things have really shifted for me. And at the same time, I think I'm still the same person who still cares about people. I'm the same person who still makes mistakes all the time. What I've learned most is to slow down and know that my life had not provided me with all of the correct information about our country. And so at any given turn now, I try to just take a step, take a breath, and try to figure out what I might be missing before making a judgment.
How fulfilling has that been for you?
Personally, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I have found this a completely liberating experience. Yeah. I think as a white person, I actually feel comfortable walking into any room and saying, sure, let's talk about race, regardless of who's in the room. And I don't know that many white people, other than people who do this work alongside me, who can say the same thing. Not that it's always an easy conversation, and not that it won't have messy elements to it, but I still would rather be in it, because ultimately we end up in better and deeper relationships because of it, because the conflict avoidance that I got taught as a young person, once getting over that, I started to realize, no, having people be interested enough to be in that conflict with me, that's an investment.
When you walk into that room of white people and start having this conversation, what generally is the reaction to it?
I think people are really hungry for it. I think people are really glad, because I think it's a conversation that doesn't happen enough. I think there's a lot of fear around, I'm going to be made to feel bad, I'm going to be shamed, all they want me to do is feel guilty. There are all these fears around it. But when I walk into a room, and when my colleagues walk into a room, and we start talking about race and our experience and what can open up with it, it starts to feel more like an opening and an invitation and a responsibility and the possibility of actually doing this well, as opposed to just a haranguing.
But it's so uncomfortable for people to talk about.
It is.
Which is part of the problem.
Yeah, but it's uncomfortable to learn anything new. Yeah. It's always a challenge to feel that you're not good at something yet. To recognize that, wow, my society didn't create literacy in me in terms of race. It is uncomfortable, and it can feel very betraying that, you know, my education system, my community didn't teach me how to do this well. And in fact, the people of color around me are light years ahead of me on this subject. So yeah, there is something we have to get over, which is the I know it all part. And that can be a challenge, but I think ultimately it's freeing to do so.
Yeah, you were not taught well because no one taught the people who were teaching you.
Well, no kidding. And as a teacher educator,
right,
I am very, very, very well aware that, yeah, you know, those of us who are going into the education field, if we don't get a handle on this, then we are not going to educate the next generation better. Yeah. So I'm exceedingly pleased when I do run into educators who have, you know, taken the time, taken the effort, and joined up with people who can continue to educate them. And again, more and more across the nation, white people are coming together together to do this so that we don't end up doing, which is a very classic challenge, which is expecting people of color to be our teachers. But when we join networks with one another so that we can share in this progression forward, we can do a lot of good.
We have to take a break. We're talking with Dr. Shelley Touchluck, the author of Living in the Tension, The Quest for Spiritualized Racial Justice and Witnessing Whiteness, The Need to Talk About Race and How to Do It. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, we'll take that at STL On Air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to our conversation now with Dr. Shelley Touchluck, author of Living in the Tension, The Quest for a Spiritualized Racial Justice and Witnessing Whiteness, The Need to Talk About Race and How to Do It. Shelley, when we talk about whiteness, what are we really talking about? Are we talking about skin color? Are we talking an attitudinal thing? What are we talking about?
Yeah, so a lot of academics will talk about whiteness as a set of ideas, an attitudinal thing more so. I think we can do that, and we can have that conversation. When we talk about whiteness, we can go into a whole list of sort of norms or tendencies or things like that. I do like to differentiate that from white people. I think white people can have very different relationships to their whiteness. So I know lots and lots of white people who are creating a particular racial identity around being anti-racist, or being someone who's trying to push against what those common tendencies over time had been.
Do you think white people feel guilty about being white in their relationships with Black America?
I think a lot of people do. Yeah. I think that... I think that there is a large push to try to help white people who feel guilty to understand that that's not what is asked for. That by and large, people of color that I know aren't looking for guilt, because guilt doesn't solve the problem. Mm-hmm. What people are yearning for is for learning and action steps and betterment. And so if a certain level of a twinge of guilt helps somebody to take more action, okay, good. But I don't think that's the point and the purpose, at least anymore. It may be true that there was a time period, because we've all evolved in how we work on these issues. There may have been a time period where some workshops and some diversity leaders, let's say, were looking to try to encourage some guilt in order to get an emotional response. Mm-hmm. That may be true. I think at this time, those that I know in the field are not focusing that way.
I wonder if some white people aren't afraid, and I mean this because they're recognizing that in a very few years they're going to be the minority, and the shoe is essentially going to be on the other foot. I think a lot of people recognize that's happening. You can see it in every city, in most communities. You can see the complexion changing, if I can put it that way.
It's an interesting thing to think through. Why would that be a scary thing? I mean, what would it mean to be the minority? Does it mean that one is afraid that one is going to be treated poorly because their group has treated someone else poorly?
That would be my take on it.
That's a pretty grand admission of the group having done some horrible things. So to me, a person who is already recognizing that is right there on the edge of understanding that white privilege has been in action for hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, how would you put it? Do you think that's just a poor notion?
Which?
The fear factor of becoming the minority.
I think it, just as I think a lot of prejudice is born of a sense of strangeness and a lack of knowing people, I think that fear is in the same way. It's a fear of what is unknown. It's a fear of people that are unknown. And I do not think it is an educated position. I think it's an understandable position in terms of being afraid of something you don't know. But I think in this day and age, there are too many ways for us to get out and get to know others and people. Mm-hmm. And to look at what's happening now and just hunker down and sit in the fear, I think is really going to be the downfall of, I mean, our culture really needs us to take a step forward here.
It's also my impression that a lot of white people are concerned because they are typically called racist and blacks are not. And yet they say, well, there's black racism as well. And that has to be confronted and dealt with. How do you do that?
I do it with sort of a both and. I both believe that definitions are important and I don't like getting caught up with them. But here I think it's useful. I think that, like a lot of people in a lot of academics will write, that everybody's got prejudices. And so I think that's an equal opportunity problem. And so I don't have any problem saying that all groups have to work with their prejudices about other groups. I think there is a And it might seem a bit abstract, but there is a large segment of people that talk about the ism of racism as being more centered within power, power to do something in large mass against another group. And in that sense, when we're talking about racism, we're talking about large systems of power. We're talking about large ideas that continue to affect people in large groups over time. And I think it's hard to argue that white people in large mass are being oppressed right now because of their race. And therefore, I think for me, I am absolutely ready to have the conversation about how do people work on their unconscious bias or the prejudice. And I think all groups need to work on that. And I think when it comes to looking at how systems have been set up to negatively affect other groups that are not white, I think that is still the essential conversation to have.
I'm not sure that I fully get the connection between spirituality and what we're talking about here, particularly with regard to activism and racial issues. Can you elaborate on that for me?
Sure. So the work that I've been looking at most recently, it is very personal. And so the book that I've currently put out has a number of themes that I do think make the relationship between what happens if our spirituality is completely divorced from racial justice, but it equally does the opposite. It says, what if our racial justice is completely divorced from a more spiritual or a more personal growth orientation? Mm-hmm. And so it really doesn't come down only on one side, but it does try to create at the end of each chapter a sense of how do we marry these together? Because I think, for example, there are groups that have always had these two things in tandem. For example, in the civil rights era, the faith traditions were right there marching and being part of social rights and civil rights movements. And I think that is a wonderful example of things working well together. I am particularly concerned, coming from where I do with the people that I'm around, that people move toward a sense of, well, I have transcended race. I have become so evolved in my sense of whatever my practice is that people who are still paying attention to race are somehow locked into the social realm while I'm operating in the spiritual realm. And I am trying to disengage that and sort of ask people to say, but are we not social beings still? And how is that connected to our spirituality too?
You mentioned the role that faith organizations have played in the past. When the Ferguson problems erupted here almost 2 years ago now, there was a great call from the clergy, you know, for calm and to approach this differently than it was being approached at the time. But there seemed to me there was a disconnect there, that there was a generational component, that the people in the streets were not listening to the people in the pulpit. I mean, that's a tough connect to make sometimes.
Yeah, I think it is, and that's probably to some degree some parallel element of the prompt that got me to write this book is, you know, I am a person who thinks of myself as spiritual. I go to places that are actually quite multiracial, but focusing on the us coming together and focusing on this beauty and this forward path. And then I also operate in political spaces where it seems like the messages from this more future-oriented, spiritual, loving sort of kumbaya flavor is not accepted. And that is exactly why I wrote the books. I think we need each other.
How do you define spiritual in this context?
Yeah, extremely broadly is the best way to answer it, because this book's only been out for 3 months, and this is the primary question that people ask. I'm not speaking about any particular religion. My particular approach to spirituality may be different than any others. And so for me, the best way I can say it is that aspect of my deep sense of how I connect to something greater than myself, whether it's all of humanity, whether it's some creator or an invisible being, wherever somebody wants to go with that will still work for this conversation to me.
Is this something that has evolved personally with you, something that has come along with your increasing awareness of the world around you?
It's certainly developed over time. I had the great fortune of having a mentor who brought me into conversations on race, class, and spirituality simultaneously. And so while I was having sort of a spiritual, you know, evolution, I was focusing more academically on race. So it sort of makes sense that I would speak most readily on race first. But eventually I started to see that the combination, I think, is just really helpful and useful.
We have a tweet here I'd like to read to you and get your response to. Talking racism is like talking about money. Nobody wants to expose that information to anybody else.
Yeah.
It sounds like a valid point to me.
Yeah, it is hard, and it is something we don't like to do. That doesn't make it any less important.
Yeah. So what is your best advice to people who are listening who would like to become engaged but are perhaps fearful or certainly uncertain as to how to proceed? What's your advice?
Yeah, my best advice is to actually go to that website and start looking at the information at search, surj.org, and try to find the information that seems useful. See if there is a chapter of people nearby. I absolutely think that the YWCA program that is on Witnessing Whiteness is a really beautiful orientation to this, because it isn't meant to make people feel bad. It is meant to help people grapple with what those fears are and name what the concerns are and be able to understand and unpack why those fears are actually part of the problem. And when we come together to talk about it, the fear starts to go away. I have the benefit of having been part of an all-volunteer organization in Los Angeles called Aware LA, and we've been meeting monthly for 13 and a half years. And, you know, in a kind of silly way, I can say it's a little bit of like a support group, but in some ways it is. We get together and we talk about what the challenges are. We support each other to do better when we get back out there into our multiracial world. And I just can't say enough about how beautiful it can feel to reach out to talk to other people who are also interested in the same idea.
What have you been hearing about the reaction and the response to the YMCA programs here
and
elsewhere? Yeah, what did I say?
You said YMCA.
YWCA. I stand corrected. Go ahead. What have you been hearing?
You know, I've been hearing that it is a space where people can start to see the world in a different way, and in a way that is opening, that it reduces fear. And it's all the same things I've really said. I think the spirit of it really is, I don't want to say gentle, because I know that it's hard to do this stuff, but it's meant to be a supportive, inviting, helpful space. And I think that's how people are experiencing it. I was just in Des Moines, Iowa a couple days ago, and they're also using this work there at a church group. And they did an assessment pre and post and found a lot of statistically significant shifts in the difference, a reduction in the gap between the beginning where they had a certain sense of how they felt they saw the world versus sort of the reality of what they saw. The gap closed. So they were able to see things in a way that was much more accurate afterwards.
And the people who are attending these sessions, do you have any sense at all whether it's, I assume it's predominantly white, but is there Black involvement?
The ones that are here in St. Louis and that I know of most are taking the opportunity to have these be white affinity or white caucus spaces so that white people can work exclusively with each other on this. Usually they're somehow in some relationship with people of color within their organizations or whatnot, somehow affiliated. But the whole process was created to be able to be done multiracially. So it can go either way, and it really depends on the organization.
Right. I should point out, our time is just about up, that you're going to be appearing today at 5:30 at the YWCA. At the Wheatley Heritage Center on Locust. That's this afternoon at 5:30. There are other events, private events, that you're involved in as well. Is that correct?
Well, tomorrow morning I'm going to be sitting in a dialogue with some of the facilitators of the Witnessing Whiteness program. And so, you know, they've been running this for 4 or 5 years here. I think I heard a number that they're close to having 1,000 people have come through this program over the number of years. And so we're just going to talk about what kind of movement they might make forward and how they construct their program. And so I think just knowing about that and knowing that this program is hopefully continuing is good to suggest.
That's got to be very gratifying for you to have so many people that are paying attention.
You know, I do find it hopeful. I'm certainly not the only one who's doing this. And, you know, the materials are free and available online. So if people want to, you know, look up my website, it's my name, ShellyTetchluck.com. And under Witnessing Whiteness, there's an entire workshop series. It's free. It's downloadable. That's how the Y got a hold of it. Also, the information for the current book and where that's going to be, all of that's available. I am hoping to develop a similar series for the new book, but I'm going to wait for probably a good year to start to get responses from the field. If there are organizations who think it will be useful, then I'll do that too.
Right. I want to give the spelling of your last name, because that's might be difficult for people. It's T-O-C-H-L-U-K, Touchluck. Okay. One other thing about, I've got a note here from the producer, and there may be a correction we need to make with the website. It's showinguporacialjustice.org, correct?
I believe so.
Okay.
They can just Google showing up for racial justice. You're
okay.
Get
all
it.
Right. We'll get that squared away. We'll figure it out and get it right on our website. Shelley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great to talk to you. Come back and see us again when you get the program set up for the second book. Shelley Touchluck. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.